Welcome back, everybody, to the Placeholders Podcast. I'm Kaylee Fretz. It's Tuesday, January 24th. We've got a great show for you today. We've got news of Tom Boonen's legs. We've got news of Nairo Quintana's potential imminent retirement. We've got news of somebody pulling out of their pedals and a bunch of other stuff. With me here today, Dan Cash, how are you?
I'm doing great, Kaylee. Thanks for asking.
You're very welcome. Welcome to the show. Dave Rome, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Good to be back.
And because we were talking about Tom Boonen's legs and we texted him no more than 7 minutes ago to ask him to come on the podcast, Ian Treloar, how are you?
I'm good. I know my beat and I know when I'm wanted.
you could see the, it's like a bat dar. What's the
Batman
bat
symbol.
That's the one I'm looking for.
Just above, like illuminating the sky. But it's just legs. Just Tom Boonen's legs.
I can't wait to talk about that. We're going to talk all about a bronze sculpture of Tom Boonen's legs. We have details for you. Ian has been feverishly researching in the last 7 minutes, and we have much to talk about.
Whatever fills the time.
Whatever fills the time. Yeah, it's been a good week, I think, in bike racing and bikes in general. TDU wrapped up. Tour de San Juan is now kicked off. Dane, how did TDU end up? Jay Vine, somewhat surprising winner. What are we taking from it?
Yeah, a couple takeaways. I like the way that you phrased it. I think it was you that wrote this in the run sheet here. Jay Vine is legit. That's what it says here in the run sheet, and I concur. I think that's what we can say, I guess. I mean, the Tour Down Under with no serious climbs, it's not that indicative of too much. But, I mean, the guy won two Grand Tour stages last year. He won the Aussie National Championships in the TT, and as TT National Championships go, Australia is definitely up there for, you know, most prestigious because they have some pretty decent TT guys down there. So, yeah, I think Jay Vine really showed a lot. He showed that he can kind of be a good leader across six stages. He did everything that was required of him. Took the lead on the third stage, which is the fourth day of racing because there's a prologue. And he hung on through the final stage onto Mount Lofty, where Simon Yates took a nice little, I don't want to call it a consolation win, because it was nice and it wasn't that small of a thing to take a stage win and finish second. But I think Jayco Alula probably wanted to do a little bit more in the home race for them. Michael Matthews had some, let's call them technical issues at one point. He had a nice race, but what are you going to do? And then Yates finished second overall. So tip of the hat to them. Tip of the hat to Jay Vine. A real tip of the hat, I would say, to Rowan Dennis. Had a great stage victory. I was very impressed with the way that he attacked with, I don't know, maybe a K to go, not far left in the race, out of a group of four riders, little cat and mouse game, four riders from four different teams on stage two. And Rowan Dennis, known for his time traveling ability, so we know he's got a big engine. But we don't often see him these days using it to take his own stage wins outside of TTs. And we did see that at the Tour Down Under.
A couple little things that you mentioned there that I want to dig into slightly more. A bunch of people asked if we would talk about drop chains at TDU. Is there anything to this, Dave? Did you see anything unusual? Have you heard anything unusual? Or is this just sort of a, you know, early season, new bikes, mechanics aren't quite dialed yet kind of situation?
That's where my mind goes with this stuff, is it's often the Tour Down Under, you actually see the mechanics arrive with like frame sets, and they're in some cases, if they can't get the rider their bike straight from service course, they're actually building bikes up from the race. I think you add in the fact that there's some teams on new equipment, you add in the fact that this there's often mechanics moving between teams as well, year to year, just as riders move, mechanics move as well. So they might be new to a certain drivetrain. And I think all of this adds up to the fact that, you have some teething issues.
So not a whole lot to be, no controversies around the drop chains, I would say, at TDU.
No, I don't think so. I think it's, unfortunately, it's just In almost all cases, it's a setup issue, and you know, it's just the mechanics might be an eighth of a turn off on the limit screw or something as simple as that, and then you know you add 1,000 watts from a rider and you have issues. So they'll sort it once the bigger races come around. They'll have it sorted.
All right, so not much to that one. The other tidbit, actually, it's not a tidbit. It was the winner of the bicycle race. I did write that Jay Vine is legit, but my question is, how legit is he? Obviously, like you said, Dane, it is TDU. It's a big, important race, but it's also the first race. There's not a whole lot of major climbs. And yet I saw some hot takes floating around the internet this week that he was like a Grand Tour contender and a whole bunch of other things that seem somewhat far-fetched to me. I mean, this is obviously incredibly talented rider, but his first year in the elites is 2021. He's already 27 years old. It would seem to me that maybe a couple years in the future, that's a possibility. But what's your take on it?
Well, I would say whether or not Jay Vine is a Grand Tour contender has almost nothing to do with what I saw at the Tour Down Under. He may be, but if he is, it's because I've seen him do really well at the Vuelta, which is a Grand Tour, on a hard climb that goes to altitude, which one does not do at the Tour Down Under, really. So, yeah, I think he showed some of, I guess, what our American sports talk shows would call intangibles in the leadership department at the Tour Down Under. But in general, the things you need to win a Grand Tour, you don't really see them at the Tour Down Under. So maybe he's a Grand Tour guy. I don't know, but you don't get that from the Tour Down Under. So
no,
yeah.
There's a couple riders ahead of him on that list at UAE as well.
Just a few. The team has been known to put some decent Grand Tour types out there, and maybe he's one of them. By the way, and he certainly could be one of them. But again, we're not going to know that because of Tour Down Under, and it's not just because it's a week long race. It's just there's really no very hard climbs in the Tour Down Under. There's some short, punchy climbs. I think you can maybe establish yourself as somebody who might be the kind of rider to win a short, punchy kind of race at the Tour Down Under. But nothing at the Tour Down Under takes that long to get up and over, so it doesn't really tell me much about Jay Vine as a Grand Tour guy.
One of the comments that I, or one of the pieces of discourse that was floating around was that he had been demonstrated as an outstanding climber. And then he crossed off whether time trialing was a potential, you know, weakness. So he can climb and he can time trial. Maybe it doesn't go any further than that in terms of these are the major things you need to tick off on your list in order to be considered a Grand Tour contender. But as for the team composition, as we've mentioned, UAE is pretty stacked. Is it Almeida that he'd be battling against for the leadership? Would they give George Bennett a crack? Bennett was riding in support of Vine at the Tour Down Under. And then a little tangent nugget. Him and Mark Hershey missed the final presentation because they went off to McDonald's at the end of the last stage and were just sinking some Maccas.
How is this the first time I've heard of this?
Yeah,
that is the best thing I've heard so far this year. I mean, we're only 24 days into the, well, 25 for you. That's awesome. Wow, it's skyrocketed to the top of my favorite riders list.
Is there any reporting on what was ordered?
I definitely saw chips. And I also noted that both of them seem to be drinking Fanta, which is the worst of the Coca-Cola amateur sub-brands.
Okay, whoa. Ian, come on, man.
Why? Whoa. Why?
I've covered this extensively at another publication, but it just seems to be a drink that is beloved by the professional peloton for reasons that I don't understand. Because the thing with Fanta is the first mouthful, so good. Like it's a little bit tart, it's got the bubbles, and then the further you go in that can, it gets worse and worse and worse. And by the end, there is no staying power. It is dreadful.
Well, I would say I have a very strong different opinion on this, but that's a very nuanced opinion about Fanta that you have there, Ian. And I'm impressed that you have such a nuanced opinion about Fanta.
Well, the other issue, you need to understand that a drink is not just the first mouthful. You need to understand that drink is what it's doing at the end, when it's warmed up a little bit, when a little bit of the carbonation has gone down.
And you also need to understand that you're taking an Australian's point of view on this from the mid, you know, from 2000s and earlier, where Fanta was just an orange drink. But elsewhere in the world, Fanta is like a brand of drink, many flavors. So are you just saying all flavors have the same issue?
Well, I am aware of this, and this is another bugbear of mine, because in Norway, my wife is Norwegian. So if you're in Norway and you're talking about Fanta, you're talking about what in Australia we would call Solo or Lift. It's like a lemon flavored thing. And there's also a tropical one, which is garbage. It's just, it's a real mess. But anyway, I think the fact remains that Fanta is at the lower end of that sort of fact. Yeah.
Okay. That's a strong opinion.
Yeah.
Always happy to come in with a hot take.
Clearly we're not going to agree on everything on this podcast. And this is one of those times.
If you want more of something kind of like that, check out the album files, where Ian will go and tell you about every drop of some sort of album.
Well, just knowing who does the album files, would anybody on there have a positive thing to say about Fanta or McDonald's fries for that matter? I feel like you need to have some balance there, guys.
Extremely pro McDonald's fry, extremely anti Fanta.
Okay.
And the album files, I feel like we're being miscast as a pack of negative Nellies. just like unfairly critiquing things. It's not like that at all.
I only meant it in that you dissect an album in a similar manner to the way
Okay, so incisive, a can of Fanta. Incisive cultural commentary. Thank you.
Exactly.
Cool.
Well, what on earth were we talking about?
Throw it under. I had one more tip of the hat of the throw it under, if we can get back to the bike
race.
All
right, Dane, bring us back. Bring us back.
Brian Kokar has been racing at the World Tour level since I have been covering bike racing. He was at the GP Quebec, GP Montreal, the first time. And I think that was the first World Tour race I ever went to. 9 years ago now? I think it was 9 years ago. And I remember he was sitting at the bar. I was brand new to all this. This goes way back, Brian Kokar. In that time, he has been sort of hyped as a potential winner of race after race after race. Has never won a World Tour race until last week. He finally got his first ever World Tour victory. And Brian Kokar, chapeau, hats off to you for finally doing that. And I think there's a lot of people out there who, at this point, said, okay, I'm not going to bet on Brian Kokar anymore because he just doesn't win World Tour races. And after 10 years, he's done it.
He showed them. Mm-hmm.
I loved seeing this. The fact that he had never won a World Tour race, I think, was unknown to me. That was a stat that did not sit in the back of my head and is somewhat stunning. So much like some other riders in the peloton, I am a bit of a closet Brian Kokard fan, and it is because I can't help but root for riders that lose.
Oh yeah,
for some reason, and he lost in quite spectacular fashion. It was 2016. I'm trying to remember the stage number. It was the longest stage of that Tour de France. I do remember that, and he lost by about half a tire to one dominant Marcel Kittel that day. I think Kittel was already on 2 or 3 stage wins that Tour de France. He would go on to win a couple more. And Kokard, who, as we were just saying, has never won a World Tour stage, had never won a Tour de France stage, still has not won a Tour de France stage, was half a tire off. And I have never seen, I don't think, a second place rider as devastated as Brian Kokard was in that particular moment. And you could almost tell that Marcel Kittel was kind of felt bad for him. Like almost like Kittel had wanted Kokard to actually be the winner in the photo finish, which I think speaks a little bit to Kittel's own personality. But anyway, it was kind of a moment that stuck with me. Watching, I think I was standing about 10 feet away, Brian Kokard kind of collapsed on the ground. They're all waiting around for the photo finish to be official. Word comes in and he just sort of melted. And in that moment, again, I became a bit of a Brian Kokard fan. I just wanted him to win the bike race. And So I was exceptionally happy to see that he did so this last week and finally got that win against a pretty decent field. Not a like a Tour de France field, obviously, but a, you know, halfway decent sprint field.
Yeah, there actually really were some pretty talented sprinters at the Tour de France this year. And also Brian Kukar, although he has been around for so long because he was a track star before he was before he was a road star, he was doing things on the track. I think he's a silver medalist in the Olympics. He's only 30 years old, which, you know, if Mark Cavendish is any indication, would suggest that maybe he can go win a couple of more World Tour races this year, maybe next year, maybe the year after that, because you can keep doing things after you're 30, I keep telling myself. So hopefully we'll see that this year. We'll see some more wins from him. Because I agree with you, Kaylee. I was a big fan. I was really happy when, for similar reasons, Giacomo Nattolo won a stage at a Grand Tour after all those years. So yeah, I like seeing the guys who have trouble winning finally win.
Well, he's a very particular skill set, Brian Kukar does, which is he's quite a small sprinter as well. He's just a small guy as sprinters go. And so obviously what comes out of that is he accelerates quite well and he does uphill finishes quite well. So there is a particular kind of finish that at one point in time, you know, his name was thrown in the hat every single time we had a finish like that. He never actually won one, but he was always second or third or very, very close. And I hope he gets back to that form. And I hope, you know, we've actually, that sort of finish is now more and more common in races like the Tour and the Giro. And so if he can find that old form again, you know, could be a great year for him. Fingers crossed. Should we move on from TDU? I think we should. It was great to be back racing. Dane, is there anything of note from San Juan? Or should we sort of skip over San Juan? Anything good going on down there?
I think it is notable that American Quinn Simmons won a stage of San Juan, kind of outfoxed the sprinters on stage three, which was expected to be a sprinter kind of day in the Autodromo. No, wait, I said that wrong. In the Autodromo de Villicom, he managed to, steal a march, as some British commentators like to say. I like that one. By the way, Kaylee, you kind of did me dirty last week.
I was
hating on British commentators for their poor pronunciations, which, again, if you say Quesadilla, I'm not going to let it go. But then you kept it in the podcast. So I'll say this week, I do often hear some great phrases from British commentators like steal a march. You don't hear that very often on American commentary. And that's exactly what Quinn Simmons did in stage three of the Vuelta San Juan. Stages one and two, by the way, won respectively by Sam Bennett and Fabio Jakobsen, which good competition in the sprints at this Vuelta San Juan. And I think that bodes really well for Bennett, who needs that confidence booster. Of all the sort of specialties in cycling, the sprinters, I feel like, are the ones who build on past success the most. And so Bennett won two stages at the Vuelta last year. He's now won a stage early, very, very quickly so far this year. I think that bodes well for him kind of putting together his 2023 campaign.
I have a little tidbit from San Juan as well, but I need to remember the guy's name. Who's the Argentinian national champion? Ex-Argentinian national champion.
Lionel Messi.
Cycling. Not soccer.
What kind of...
He was Quickstep.
Max Richesi.
Yep.
This is his final race. He is retiring. Yeah. He has a...
Oh, is it really?
Yeah, he's riding for the national team. He was slated to be on B&B Hotels, and then that fell through, and then there was a sad quote from him that Mark Cavendish stopped returning his calls, which is sad. So anyway, he's riding his final race there after a long and remarkable career as a lead-out great.
Really good lead-out man.
Mm.
Yeah, yeah. That quote, which I had missed about Cav not returning his calls, does lend some credence to not the exact thing that B&B Hotels was saying about Cav retiring, because that's obviously not true. But essentially that Cav pulling out of that team is a large part of the reason why sponsorship fell through. Now, I think you could very much argue, as we have before, that they probably shouldn't be entirely reliant on a rider that they haven't even fully signed yet to pull in sponsorship, but that does lend some credence to that theory.
Speaking of, where is Cav at the moment?
Where's Cav?
There is Cav in all of us.
Where was Cav last seen?
Well, so, I mean, we have that photo of him getting in the Astana car in Spain.
And I know he's announced it and Astana have announced it, but are we sure that he is at Astana?
I do want to bring it back real quick to Richesi because
that's less happy.
I think there was a period of 3-4 years where Richesi was kind of seen as the best or you know, one of the top three lead-up men in the whole peloton. And him retiring, I think it's a shame that it's kind of happening in this sort of sudden way because a lot of riders get to do the whole, well, I'm going to retire at the end of the year, so every race is sort of a celebration. That's not going to happen for Richesi. Bit of a bummer for him. He does at least get to ride with the Argentine national team at his home stage race before he calls it a career.
He's also had a bit of an unfortunate couple of years. He was one of the COVID recipients at the UAE Tour. Spent quite a long time in the UAE recovering from that. Missed his daughter's birth, I believe, as a result. And then has just sort of been drifting ever since.
Yeah, he and Gaviria both had a really rough... Like, I complain about how rough my February was that year because I had to stay in a hotel room for, like, 3 days without going outside of the room. And they had to stay in the whole in the UAE for, like, a month. So they had it a lot worse than I had it.
And they get COVID.
They also got COVID. I did not get COVID from that experience. Yep. And Mauro Venier was the one who sort of gave me some paperwork to fill out. When I got my tests, which was kind of wild that the Giro director was the guy doing that because it was really all hands on deck. Yeah, but that was rough for both Richesi and Gaviria.
That was quite an episode. I don't know if I should admit this, but I always just assumed that Richesi was Italian.
He kind of looks like a like an old like 1950s Italian actor. Like he's got a sort of long, sad face, like sorrowful eyebrows. He looks like he could be in black and white. He is forever in sepia, that man.
Yeah.
I'm always trying to, you know, make sure we're all educated. So hashtag the more you know. Like a huge percentage of the Argentine population is of Italian descent. So he very likely, I mean, I don't know, but that, there's a decent chance.
I mean, the name would suggest.
Yeah.
Yeah. The name would suggest some Italian heritage.
A little bit of the population of German descent as well.
Well, that's
a little bit. Anyway,
cut that, out.
Cut that bit out. Should I? I don't know.
Related and not for recording, but you, Ian, you would like The Hunters with it's a new show on Prime.
Okay. Pacino's in that, right?
With who is
Pacino
that?
Is in that, right?
Yeah, Pacino. Yeah, they end up in Argentina.
All right.
Anyway. Yeah, back to the recording.
We have additional South American retirement news, or potential retirement news.
Maybe.
Friend of the podcast, Nairo Quintana. He is apparently maybe retiring next week. What's going on?
Yeah, so he's called a press conference, basically, and Colombian media is reporting that the reason for his press conference is the impending announcement of his retirement. So as of Tuesday, January 24th here in the U.S. or Wednesday, January 25th down in Australia, that's what we know. So we may have heard news by the time this podcast goes up. Maybe the news is out. I don't know. But right now it sounds like the rumors suggest that he's going to be announcing his retirement after an interesting career. I mean, when he was 23 years old, he certainly seemed like he was the, you know, quote unquote, next big thing. He did end up winning some very big races and ended up being a very, you know, important part of the peloton for quite a long time, a great rider. I think at the same time, most people who saw him when he was, you know, racing up Ventoux with Chris Froome in 2013 would have expected for him to have achieved more before retiring. So we don't know where he's going to retire, but it certainly sounds that way at the moment.
That's a shame.
He could also just be on the next season of Masked Singer.
That would be awesome.
That would be fantastic.
He did the last one. He crashed out in the first round, and I like to believe that 2023 is the redemption year.
What was his costume?
He was a chameleon, and he was doing a kind of reggaeton kind of thing.
The song that he picked was cool. It was like a cover of Rhythm of the Night, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's good. I can't really speak to his ability to sing, but the song was cool. So
I mean, he performed better than I would have expected Nairo Quintana to perform. But that was quite a low bar to clear.
The man who doesn't even smile trying to record. All right, we got one more little news bit here before we get into two little news bits. The not particularly important one, but I'm just keeping everybody updated. The National Cycling League, the sort of crit league that we've talked about a couple times in this podcast, they announced their calendar today. They're going to have an opening race in Miami, which would be home to the Miami Knights, if you will remember correctly. And then they'll have another race in Denver, home to the Denver Disruptors, on August 13th. And
is there one in Michigan for the Michigan Midges?
There's also there's a race in Atlanta and another in Washington, D.C. Like I said, the first one is in Miami on April 8th. So coming up relatively soon. Don't have any additional information on that for you other than it's happening and we're keeping an eye on it because it's a fascinating story and it's a fascinating thing. So,
and
that
there's
aside.
Not much else happening in the U.S. bike scene.
Very little else happening in the U.S. bike scene. A lot of like Lifetime Grand Prix things happening right now.
Oh, yeah.
It's not really our cup of tea on this particular podcast, but maybe we'll get into it later in the season.
I'd like
Quinn Simmons did win a race today, by the way. I mean, that's something. And Sepkus exists. Yeah. There are good American bike racers out there.
There's good American bike races, just no good American bike races.
True and depressing.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. There's no, well, road races.
Road races.
Racing.
We should
yes.
say.
Yeah. Yes. 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 Yes.
Maybe the NCL will fix that. I don't know. I'm just fascinated by it because they have a lot of money. And anything with a lot of money at least has a long runway. So we're gonna find out exactly how that goes, I think, this year and next. But now we get to really the marquee story of today's podcast. The reason why we texted Ian with 7 minutes notice for this podcast. Well, you know, I'm just going to throw it to you. What terrifying, fascinating, beautiful thing happened in Belgium last weekend?
It's certainly two of three of those. Tom Bonin has a statue of his legs. Which was announced by various different Belgian media outlets, including Sportza, with very good pictures of Tom Bonin looking at his legs, Tom Bonin clapping at his legs, an array of people surrounding Tom Bonin's legs, just in awe of the legs. It is a brass statue of both the full sum of Tom Bonin's legs.
I haven't been on this beat, so I'm just going to ask some questions because I've seen a photo, haven't really looked into it, thinking that you would answer these questions for me.
I like that you saw the picture and didn't immediately want to know everything else
it. I wanted to leave a little mystery for myself.
Little treats for later, go.
As a cyclist, male cyclists, when they shave their legs, can have the trouble of not knowing how far to shave up. Where to draw the line? Where have they drawn the line with the legs?
They've drawn the line with the legs about where they stop being legs and start being other appendages, I would say. That's
did his legs turn into arms? Because
where it becomes a V-shape?
Is that what an appendage is? Have I misused the word?
Yeah,
arms and legs.
I was talking about the bone and bone.
Got it. Maybe it's an appendage for Bonin. Maybe his, yeah.
I wish them both well. So the legs go up to about hip, but there are no, crucially, no buttocks. There is.
So do they end? Would they kind of create a V at the shape at which they end up?
Yeah. Yeah, it's like,
okay.
All right. No, sorry. They are two standalone.
No, he's got considerable thigh gap.
They're disembodied, right? There's there's no hips at all, right?
Yes. Yeah, no. They stop below the hip.
Okay.
Or where the hip would
be. But with a flat top or like a 45 degree angled top?
Like a weird sort of domed kind of thing.
Oh, okay.
That's my least favorite bit. When you spend a lot of time looking at the picture, you realize that all of it is not something that you like looking at. But that part in particular is the part that I don't like looking at more than the rest of it.
Is it exactly life size, like exact to scale, or is it slight different?
It seems
different height. Like,
no,
it
seems to be to scale, but
yeah,
Tom Bonin in the pictures next to Tom Bonin's legs is wearing pants, so you can't get like precise nuance because there's jeans, which might be muddying the waters a little bit. A little pair of sneakers, maybe.
They're very tight jeans, though, so you can get a pretty close idea, I think.
Further questions, if I may. Flexed, non-flexed? What's the position of these?
I think with Tom Bonin, you've got a natural underlying level of like lifelong fitness.
Yeah, sure.
So they look like they're strong legs, but I don't think that it's an obvious like
and
muscle striation or anything like that.
Yeah,
and that's the other big question is at what point did they take the moldings for this? Because are we talking like retired Bonin, or are we talking like Roubaix winning Bonin legs?
I mean, it would have been quite a sleeper of a statue if they'd been casting his legs 15 years ago. But
time capsule.
Maybe that's what they do. Maybe every winner of, you know, Tour of Flanders or whatever, that's part of the post-race formality. You just go and stick your legs in some plaster of Paris.
When they say they're going to the air quotes showers, what they're actually doing is they're getting a cast of their legs.
Just the little dippy legs.
Visiting Madame Tussauds for a wax sculpture, which can then be used for statue making later.
It is a very difficult profession being a pro cyclist when you factor in all of this kind of admin. But what I've learned is that from Sportza, who have written a very good article that starts with a picture with a very funny caption of Tom Bonin looks at his legs and then really goes up from there. What I've learned is that Tom Bonin played an active role in the creation of the artwork, not just in being a member of the jury that chose that was the statue that he wanted, but he actually posed for it. He stood on one leg for 3 hours, then on the other, also for 3 hours. And then those legs were painted with a kind of latex, quote, layer by layer by layer. So that's many layers of latex. He's very happy with it. He couldn't be more pleased with his legs. There were some very nice entries, he says, but for me, this immediately stood out. I said to the jury that this had to be it for me, and then the rest followed.
Further questions. Talk to me about the location of the legs.
Wait. What's the point of a jury for Tom Bonin's legs if Tom Bonin is on the jury? I mean, it's a one-man jury at that point, is it not? Like, what Belgian person is going to tell Tom Bonin that he cannot have the Tom Bonin sculpture?
Cancellara is also on the jury. He gets to kind of like weigh in.
Interesting.
That Tom Bonin's clearly like strong-armed the jury there because he has.
Yeah.
There is a direct quote from him saying that it is this or nothing. So he wants the legs. He also says, and this is an insane admission, I would even have wanted this in my garden.
Wow.
Interesting.
I would not.
Which
want
goes
that
back to my question of where are they?
Yeah, sorry. Yes, the factual information. At the top of the Tyenberg, which is an 800-meter climb, which is featured
also known as the Bonenberg.
The Bonenberg. And the statue. Yeah, okay. Did I say this earlier? The statue is the Bonenbeinen. Which
what?
The Bonenbeinen.
Is that legs?
Which, if we're anglicising it, would be Bonenbeinen, but the Bonin legs. The statue is the Bonin legs.
Yep.
I mean, it's a good place for it. The Tyenberg is a notorious Tom Bonin attack spot. It has a gutter up the right-hand side that he would spend quite a bit of time in and then hop out when that gutter ends. Go full gas. It was quite far away from the finish in the old Flanders, but he would use it anyway. Notorious, in fact.
He, in this article, he takes a bit of a philosophical slant at the end of talking about his insane statue of his legs, where he says, the circle was complete. So he's done all of the racing and now he's left a little brass memento of his legs at the top of a climb. Closing that circle, bringing the Bonenbeinen on the Bonenberg to its natural conclusion.
So basically, if you win a race and you don't get your legs as a statue, you have not, you haven't closed the circle.
Nope. Circle's open.
Have everyone else's circle is open.
Yeah. Have you really won the race?
No, I guess not.
It's just good food for thought. Food for thought, really.
We do have some, we have other Boonin news. Well, you have more.
I have a little sort of sub-tangent from the the leg news is that there's also a life-sized bust of Tom Boonin, which was released as part of a collaboration with a sunglass brand. So there's a big bald Boonin head that you can buy with an NFT, and only one out of three of them ever sold, which is tremendously satisfying. But there's a Boonin bust, so you can get that. Then you've got the legs. So all we really need is an enterprising sculptor to do the sort of man package, torso arms, whack the bust on top, and then you've got fully fledged sort of, I don't know, like a multimedia experience, a little golem.
Tom Boonin this week said that he might come back to racing.
Gravel?
Gravel. You guessed it, Dane.
It's always
you
gravel.
You guessed it. Yeah. Oh, well, where do all the retired roadies go? They go to gravel. Yeah, he said that this week. He said that it was something about like the fire still burning, or I can't remember the exact quote, but basically it was like, I still like competing. And if you've been following Tom Boonin, you know that he has been driving race cars and things like that. Mm-hmm. And he's threatened to come back and race the gravel, UCI gravel worlds and things like that, which I think would be pretty sweet.
He's also closely tied with the classified gearing system, so it'd be a pretty cool PR move for them if he's out and about the world's racing his product like that. So
I have to imagine like a 70% fit Tom Boonin probably still does all right at a gravel
race. At a gravel race, I think he's up there, yeah.
Yeah.
Particularly gravel. I mean, that's kind of, you would think that's sort of a skill set that he would be good at.
How old is he now? Would he be doing
42
open category or age group?
How old?
42.
Oh, that's 42. Yeah. He's still got some life.
Delverde, right?
Yeah.
Well, if you haven't seen photo of the Boonin legs, they're all over the internet. We don't have a website yet, which, I mean, Ian and I were frankly, we were devastated when this came out and there was no website to put a story on. But, you know, that'll happen at some point. You can find it elsewhere. You said Sporza was the one that had the...
I don't know if Sporza got the scoop. Sporza does have it. You can also find it on my Twitter. I don't tweet very much, so it'll be up near the top.
And that's just what, at Ian Treloar?
Yeah. Spelled in none of the ways you'd expect.
Sneaky I, N T R E L O A R.
Well done.
That was
It's vowel heavy.
So, yeah, some extra eyes in there. Go check it out. All right. It's time for Geek Warning.
Actually, you're going to use that.
Maybe. All right, geeks, and specifically Dave Rum. First thing on the list here, we've seen, and the audience out there is going to be pleased to hear this, we've seen price drops throughout the industry.
Should we save that one for the last thing to talk about?
Do you want to tease it? We just teased it, now we're going to talk about it later? All right, we can do that. Well, we'll talk about something else first then.
We'll talk about the smaller things first.
All right. Let's start with you said something SRAM derailleurs lighter. Explain.
Yeah, that's completely correct. Thanks, Kaylee. There's not much to add to that, so I think we've got it sorted. Yeah, Ratio Technology, the British company that does some cool stuff. They're probably best known for their little spool upgrade kits where they add a ratchet into a older SRAM shifters that let you convert old SRAM road shifters like 12-speed and other fun things like that. They're back at it again. They've now got a derailleur cage assembly for Eagle Axis rear derailleurs. That's the mountain bike rear derailleur that you can also use on gravel bikes. And yeah, basically it's a aluminium, lightweight aluminium cage with pulley wheels, which is designed to turn your entry wireless derailleur, the GX level derailleur, into one that is as light as an XO1. And it's just £90 is what the £90 is what they're asking for this thing. Saves about 64 grams. And I think it's just really cool that they're doing that because no one else is. And perhaps more importantly, SRAM themselves don't actually sell complete cage assemblies for those derailleurs. So even if you've got like an XO1 and you found yourself a stick that likes your derailleur too much, now you have an option.
What's the price difference between those two at retail? So how much are you saving?
I don't have that information, but it's more than that. It's a bigger difference than that. And it's, so yeah, I mean, you can basically buy a GX derailleur now, then get Ratio Technologies cage. I haven't ridden it. I can't tell you. I can't say whether it performs as well. I assume it's, for most people, there won't be any noticeable difference. But yeah, you can basically, for less money, get yourself a lighter derailleur now.
Good news all around.
I just love stuff like that. I love brands offering legitimate upgrades or alternatives for keeping old parts running or getting existing parts to a higher level. I just want more of that in the industry. So, yeah, happy to see it.
I like the sort of tuning culture of it too, right? When you take something and you spend not an insane amount of money, $90, and make it quite a bit lighter. We promised a couple episodes ago that we were going to talk about dumb things we did as weight weenies. I had a bunch of people send me fantastic stories, so thank you to everybody who did that. We're not going to do it today because we don't have enough time because we had to talk about Tom Boonen's legs, but on a future episode, definitely. We have some good stories. So like we'll do like a special call-in episode or something like that where people can give us their stories and it as well. Anyway, next on our list here, another thing that a couple people reached out about on social media, hit me up in the DMs, etc., asking about riders pulling out of their pedals at TDU. Yeah. What's going on?
Emils Lepins, is that how I, Lepins? How would you say it? The Latvian rider with Trek Segafredo?
That sounds right. Wrong, but none of us are going to get any closer.
Okay. He pulled out of his pedal in one of the sprint stages. You could see it sort of maybe five or so riders back in the background. You could see him very visibly pull out of his pedal, nearly cause a chain reaction of a crash behind him. Thankfully, he stayed on. Everyone else stayed on, but could have been a lot worse. What's interesting there is that team has just moved to a new pedal system, which is Time Pedals, which is the first time Time's been back in the World Tour for a long time. Pun not intended, but it's interesting to me because I'm not necessarily going to blame the pedals. I think that pulling out of a pedal is often bad luck, but I think in this case it's as much to do with technique, and each pedal system has its quirks, and Time pedals are, I guess, known for being a bit more floaty in their feel. And I'm questioning whether that has something to do with it, that perhaps there's more float and therefore more bike swing, and therefore he just new to the pedal system ended up putting more sideways force on the pedal than perhaps he's used to doing, or and the result is being ejected from the bike.
Which is less than ideal. Yeah, and Time was recently purchased by SRAM, which is, I think, correct, the reason why the team is now on those pedals, because they're a SRAM-sponsored team.
Yes, SRAM's one's the team. The pedals themselves, they did go through a revision, but I mean, effectively, it's still very much the same Espresso pedal that was previously being sold under the previous ownership of that company. I think like any new equipment, there's going to be some tuning and trial period, and I think they're probably still in that as far as those those pedals go for the team rider's use. You know, when they're putting 1500 plus watts through those pedals and the bike's going all over the place, I mean, that's something that you might only find out in a race situation, unfortunately. It's I guess they're learning. Yep.
A brief disambiguation is that the time pedals and time frames and bikes, distinct companies that were once one, but Time Bikes is not owned by SRAM, just Time Pedals.
Correct. Well, it was previously purchased by a ski company, Kaylee. You might be able to remember and tell me who owned.
Rossignol? Was it Rossignol?
Rossignol, I believe. Yeah.
Rossignol, yeah. So they owned the time brands, and then in order to sell them, they obviously found a good buyer in SRAM to buy the pedal division, and then the frames and bikes found another buyer, which, if I'm not mistaken, is linked to Le Monde, but I could be making that up.
Noted grumpy hater Zach Edwards, friend of mine, he mentioned the other day, and I agree with him, and Dave, I would love your take on this, that the best race bikes in the history of road racing were time, specifically under Quickstep riders. Specifically Boonen in the early 2000s, which I will mention that a lot of those riders were on time pedals and were not regularly pulling out of them. So I kind of agree with your assessment on the pedal thing. But anyway, my point being that if you don't know what I'm talking about, early 2000s time frames with Tom Boonen on them, I suggest you do a Google because you will find no more beautiful thing.
Yeah. In that time period, I there I go again. I was working in a bike shop that actually had those frames for sale, and we had the limited edition Tom Boonen World Champs frame set available for sale, and I would just stare up at it and wonder, as a young child, why would anyone spend that much on a bicycle? And now I look back and I realize, one, that was actually very cheap by today's standards, but two, that bike was absolutely lovely.
So yeah, all these people messaging me asking how you can help with the placeholders. You could buy me a 2003 time team edition would be okay. You know, slide into those DMs. I'll send you my address and we'll sort this out. Thank you in advance. Last thing on the list today, we mentioned it earlier. Stuff's getting cheaper.
Yeah,
that's good news, because we basically have, you know, we've been talking for ages about everything getting more expensive all the time, and you know, 105 bikes costing $7,000 and other
105
DIT. It's still a 105 bike. It's still $7,000. Things we don't like on that front. Yeah. So give me some good news here, Dave.
Yeah. So I mean, like COVID absolutely led to this. There was the supply and demand. Demand completely outstripped supply. You also had all the logistics issues. Freight went through the roof. Exchange rates in some cases went kind of wild. And a result of that was that just bike prices went sky high, ridiculous, stupid. And thankfully, we're starting to see signs of a correction of that. It's still early days. I think there's more to come. But the first signals of this are very encouraging. So we've seen Specialized Canada announce some pretty significant price drops across a lot of their models. The pricing does, like the price drops, I'd say vary quite a lot depending on what the model is. So there's no obvious percentage or anything like that that they've dropped by. But that's really encouraging. And then Canyon in the UK have also announced some pretty big price drops with like as much as like £400 taken off of bikes. They are citing that logistic costs have come down. So yeah, the freight costs, the exchange rates, all of that is playing into the favor of the consumer, and they've adjusted their prices as such.
I'm kind of shocked that they would pass that on. Companies pass on the expenses and don't necessarily pass on the savings.
So the skeptical point, the skeptical view of that is, and skeptical / correct, is that demand is way down. We're hearing that there's a glut of supply in the bike industry all of a sudden, and that bikes are just sitting around not being sold. So yeah, I mean, the skeptical view of that is that they're lowering prices in order to be to remain competitive and to basically just make their bikes more attractive for purchase. And I think that's something that is very interesting here is I'm going to speculate that perhaps Canyon is using the UK as a test case, perhaps Specialized is using Canada as a test case. And in economics, that would be called price elasticity, where they basically just, how much of an impact price has on demand. I guess that's testing waters in markets that potentially are not the biggest for either brand, but big enough to really tell what works. I guess we'll see how things go from there. But it definitely seems that bike prices are too high for where current consumer demand is. And the other way of handling that is sales, which we're also seeing plenty of now.
So to be clear, these aren't sales. These are decreases in
price. These are permanent price decreases. Yeah. So, which is for me more encouraging than a short-term sale to try move some stock. In the end, both are offering bikes at lower prices. So, I mean, they're both achieving similar things. But I think all the complaints we've been making and all the complaints everyone else has been making for the last 2 years about how absurd bike prices have gotten, they'll still be absurd, but less so.
Great news all around. I can't imagine there's too many of our listeners out there who would be sad about cheaper bikes.
No.
I think that's it for us today. Anything else, fellas? Anything else going on that we missed? I mean, there is. There's lots going on that we missed.
There's lots.
We only have an hour.
Yeah.
A quick thank you to everybody who has shared this. We really do appreciate it. I mentioned this last time, but, I mentioned this, I think, every show. We're starting from zero here, and every single person you can put us in front of is helpful. We do have something cooking here. We got something brewing, and there are big things coming. And those big things are going to be membership driven. So we're going to be working for you out there, listeners. And that means that we're also somewhat reliant on you. We're reliant on you for revenue. We're reliant on you for sharing us and getting us off the ground. So whatever you can do on that front is very much appreciated. And everybody who's reached out, everybody who comments on Instagram posts and retweets things and all the rest, it is genuinely massively helpful. We're trying to get ourselves in front of as many people as we possibly can right now. So anything you can do on that front is appreciated.
My tool addiction is in your hands.
Fully in your hands. All right. Thanks for listening, everybody. We will be back next week with another episode of The Placeholders. Keep an ear out and share away. Bye-bye. See you.
See ya. Cheers.